and welcome to the MDS podcast, the official podcast of the International Parkinson and Movement Disorder Society. I'm Michele Matarazzo, and today we're talking about a very exciting and challenging area of Parkinson's disease research, which is gene therapy. Specifically, we'll discuss a recent phase 1b trial testing bilateral intraputaminal delivery of AAV2 GDNF, which is glial cell line-derived neurotrophic factor, in people with mild or moderate Parkinson's disease. As many of our listeners might know, neurotrophic factors like GDNF, but also others, have long been a promising therapeutic avenue in Parkinson's disease. But despite strong biological rationale and clear effects on dopaminergic neurons and good results in preclinical models, clinical translation has been very difficult so far. So this trial is part of a broader effort to overcome those problems. And joining me today is Dr. Amber Van Laar, first and corresponding author of a paper recently published in Movement Disorders. Amber is also an employee of AskBio, the sponsor of the clinical trial that we will be discussing today. So we disclose this to ensure full transparency for our listeners. Amber, welcome to the podcast and thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you so much for this opportunity.
Okay, so let's dive right in. Your team reports safety and some intriguing preliminary efficacy signals in this phase 1b trial. But before we get into the results and maybe discuss the results a bit, I'd like to step back for a moment and talk about GDNF. So it's been studied for years as a potential therapy for Parkinson's diseases, and much of that interest comes from very compelling preclinical data. Could you briefly walk us through what the preclinical evidence for GDNF showed and why it generated so much enthusiasm in the field? And we're talking about decades of research.
Yes, exactly. So I think one of the most exciting results is from, I think, the 90s, showing that GDNF is requisite for dopamine neurons to develop. And you need a little bit of GDNF for them to continue to maintain their overall health. So that was a kind of a breakthrough moment. I think there was a lot of excitement for GDNF for Parkinson's, specifically for this benefit for dopaminergic neurons. And I remember when this paper came out and immediately the next question was, oh my gosh, how are we going to get it in the brain? How are we going to get it there? And here we are, I would argue, about 3 decades later. And I think we finally figured out how exactly to do this. But with GDNF, there's a lot of promise, not only with the ability to make, you know, dopaminergic cells healthier and help them survive better, but there was some evidence of sprouting also of the dopaminergic network, which is another important feature of GDNF.
Great. After all this evidence, there have been a number of clinical trials testing GDNF and other neurotrophic factors in Parkinson's, including some using viral delivery rather than protein infusion, like your study. And we know none of them has really shown clear clinical benefit so far. Now, your approach is different in a number of ways. Gene delivery versus protein infusion, convection enhanced delivery, which is a fancy name that you will tell us what it's about, MRI guidance, even the approach, you use a posterior approach. Can you talk us through what you see as the key differences in your delivery system and why you think they might make a difference?
It was a big challenge. Neurosurgery has primarily been taking things out of the brain, and now we're trying to put drugs into the brain. And that actually took a long time to figure out how to do that and do it safely. And then when you're trying to target a particular nucleus like the putamen, like we are, even more so, how do you really contain and maintain the accuracy? So this convection-enhanced delivery is one way for us to help push the gene therapy into the right parts of the brain in a really evenly distributed way. So that was a big step in trying to get proper drug development into the brain itself. The technique allows us for a direct delivery right to the putamen, which is an important part of the dopaminergic system for us. It is downstream from the substantia nigra, but allows us to address the downstream end. This is where we expect to see a lot of the sprouting to occur. This is where we think we're going to see a lot of the benefit from it. But by using this technique as well, from a delivery technique, we're taking advantage of the networks that already exist. So we're also getting advantage of the vectors actually able to transport from the putamen back to substantia nigra in the reticulata. Now, GDNF is also secreted, so we actually get benefit all the way back at the level of the nigra as well as the putamen with this approach. So it allows us to take advantage of the normal anatomy, let's say. And we don't get that quite advantage with the protein infusions. They're intermittent. You don't get this constant level of GDNF that is elevated like we see with a gene therapy approach, like what we're doing here.
And another question is the quantity of the virus and therefore the gene that you are injecting and the coverage of the putamen. So can you discuss about this a little bit?
So with gene therapy, it's not just the amount of gene therapy we're putting in. It's actually how many cells pick up the gene and then express it. That's really our target. That's the medication here. So the idea then is that in order to make more GDNF, you need more cells picking it up, and therefore you need better coverage of your putamen. So that was a major effort of what we're trying to do with this other approach, as you had mentioned. So by taking a posterior approach, going through a prioccipital trajectory, it allows us to get the long edge of the putamen, the long axis, so we can really fill up the putamen. Again, with this idea that the more cells that we are able to transduce with our gene, the more GDNF that we'll get. And I think that was a big difference between what we've seen and a few other of the gene therapy and growth factor studies that have been done in the past.
Great. Now, let me ask you something else. One of the trials that have been done so far was published a few years ago. I think it was a paper published on Brain by Hohn and colleagues with GDNF infusions in about 40 patients or so. It was safe. It had an improvement from the imaging point of view. So it did something to the dopamine in the brain, yeah. But the patients were quite similar between the placebo and the treated arm of the trial. How do you interpret those mixed results when you were planning your study? How did you put this in the story? Yeah. And did you change the way you were thinking about your clinical trial looking at also these results?
Definitely. And I just want to add in, we actually had a phase one study that was conducted before this paper. And in that study, starting in 2013, we actually saw improvements in fluorodopa, not too dissimilar to what they had seen with the protein infusion studies with the Bristol group. So I think some of the key differences are, we said this is part of why we changed the trajectory. So that would help us improve coverage, help us get better GDNF coverage as well. And this is also where it's important to the differences, you know, higher levels of expression of GDNF that we are able to achieve with a viral approach versus a recombinant protein approach. The other thing is, like with the recombinant GDNF, it's made a little bit different. So the body sees a little bit differently. So you may not be getting the full response versus more of an endogenous GDNF that's made with a gene therapy approach that may help as well. But this also changed the population we looked at. It also changed the timing that we were looking at, because they were looking at, I think, 9 months and then on. And so I think really from a placebo effect, when we're talking Parkinson's with the population we're talking about, I think time is really where you need to start to look for a separation. Now, that being said, we haven't looked at GDNF gene therapy yet until just now in a blinded approach. And that's really going to be key to see this. But there's been a lot of smoke. I have to think there's some fire there.
Yeah. And you're right, there are so many things you can play with when designing these kind of trials, both from a technical point of view, from the clinical trial design point of view, that really believing in the molecule will work. Then there are a lot of, with the compelling preclinical evidence we have, that then there are so many factors that you have to keep into consideration when actually going into humans that makes it quite difficult, right?
The time is critical. This is Parkinson's. It doesn't happen quickly. We need to give it time to see if these therapeutics are working too.
Indeed. Now, before we get into some details of the efficacy, which is part of the results here, I want to touch on the main goal of this phase 1b study, which was safety and tolerability. What did you see in terms of adverse events? And were there any findings on imaging or clinically that you found surprising or particularly relevant, important from the safety point of view?
Yeah, it was interesting because it just very clear. There were a lot of adverse events that occurred around the time of surgery that were not that big a surprise. And there was like everything else that happened after surgery. So we ended up splitting up our like perioperative events versus postoperative events because they're very, very different. So we expected, you are flat, you're prone in the MRI for this procedure. This is all done under serial MRI. And so, yeah, we get some pains in the shoulders, the hips, a lot of musculoskeletal type of complaints just from positioning. A lot of these things are limited. They go away on their own, maybe some Tylenol. There's headaches. Again, these are things that are to be expected after brain surgery, these sorts of things. And then there's always a little bit of worsening of tremor, dyskinesia, also around the time of surgery. Usually this is anxiety. But beyond that, we were doing most of the study during the time of COVID. So we saw a lot of COVID pop up, which is not a big surprise. I guess the one surprise that we saw is compared to the phase one study that looked at a more advanced population, we really didn't see some of the cognitive changes, the hallucinations that may have occurred. I think it's because we're dealing with a younger, maybe slightly healthier, less affected PD population. No big surprises, though, from a safety standpoint. I think overall, this was really well tolerated, would be considered safe. We did see some hypointensities on MRI that we reported in the paper. These were small, incidental. We only found them because we were checking to see if there was any changes. They look stable over time. And this happened in very few people. So it's something that I think we're normalizing. What does drug delivery in the brain look like? We're not leaving any hardware behind like you would see with DBS, but there's got to be stigmata that we were there in the brain. Yes. And what does that look like? And I think that's a lot of what we're also trying to understand right now with this type of technique.
And did this happen just after the treatment, or it was something that you saw months after?
We had no reason to go look for anything because the patient was actually doing quite well. And so we were getting regular MRIs as part of our monitoring, and that's where we found it. It was at that time.
Okay. And now looking at the preliminary efficacy signals. In the paper, you described that the mild group basically stayed stable while the moderate group actually showed some numerical improvements, like lower UPDRS, less off time, even reduced levodopa requirements. Can you walk us through those findings in a bit more details, and how do you make sense especially of the difference between the two groups?
Yeah, it was also an important decision for us to look at mild versus moderate compared to other GDNF studies that had suggested that it would be better to go into an earlier PD population. And so we tried it in the study. So on average, they were about close to 2 years from diagnosis. Our moderate group was about 7.5, 8 years from diagnosis. And expected, like their UPDRS scores looked about what you would expect from diagnosis. So we did see, you know, I would argue stability in our moderate group. There were some of the participants, though, that did demonstrate some up to about 10 points of improvement on UPDRS part three. But by and large, they've remained quite stable. We did have one participant in the mild group that was found to have a TH mutation that I think ended up being somewhat symptomatic, particularly for her off scores. So especially if you take her out of the analysis, everything is completely flat. Now, that looks really boring, but I would argue, especially for an early PD patient, they're a year or two into their disease, if they could stay there, if we really can see that there's the stability that lasts for years, I think that would be quite remarkable. We haven't seen anything do that quite yet. And so I think there's a lot of value to be seen in the long-term effects from this mild group. They were not that bad to begin with. So that room for improvement, there really wasn't much. And so I think that is part of why we just don't see much change over time. But again, I think that's actually the benefit of GDNF versus our more moderate group. They've already had more loss. They've already had much worse scores on their UPDRS. There's much more room for us to demonstrate improvement. And I think that's why they look so different. And again, I think with the mechanism of action of GDNF, if we really are asking the system to regrow, resprout, and basically reconnect in a way, it takes time. I think that explains the time component with what we're seeing. But it's interesting that our off scores improved to the point where it looks like they were on their on scores before. And I think that really kind of suggests the sort of turning back the clock, this more getting back to a more mild look in the dopaminergic system is what that looks like. So again, the value here is going to be in time, what this looks like. Can we see that durability? You know, and I think on top of all of this, reducing that levodopa equivalent dose is also really remarkable. We're seeing these improvements in both off-state, on-state, and part two, plus reducing levodopa in some cases. And to me, this just altogether in totality suggests that GDNF is doing what we thought it was going to do.
Fantastic. Now, I think it's important here to mention that first of all, you say time is key. So I think you plan to follow these patients, right?
So there are regulatory requirements for at least 5 years for gene therapy. Okay. I think, again, there is major value for us to continue to do that. We'll follow even longer than that. And ideally, we need postmortem evaluation at some point.
Okay. And actually, I don't know if we said that already during this interview, but another important difference between protein infusion or neurotrophic factor infusion and the gene therapy is that the gene therapy is a one-shot therapy?
One and done, yep.
And is that really true? Is that really the case? Or do we have evidence that in the long run, we don't need another shot of the gene?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked. Again, because of the direct delivery right to the brain, that's one thing for us. Mm-hmm. And right now we have evidence. So there's some primate evidence suggesting, I think, up to 8 years of continued expression. And the phase one study done many years ago that I had mentioned, there was one participant who passed away from a back surgery. There was evidence, I think it's almost 4 years from the time he was infused, there was still GDNF that was being produced where it had been delivered. So we have some evidence there. There's also AAV2 nurturin, so very similar, a homolog to GDNF, where they've looked out 10 years or longer, and these can still see some expression there. It's the benefit of going to the brain, going straight to the neurons and asking them to gently make these neurotrophic factors long-term. It does seem like this is durable. Now, does that translate to a clinical effect? We still need to do that experiment.
Good. And as we're talking about viruses here, something else I would like to have your thoughts about is there are some groups in the gene therapy field that are looking into AAV9 because of its ability to cross the blood-brain barrier, also for immune-related things. Why did you decide to stick with AAV2 for this study? And do you think there's a role for AAV9 or maybe other serotypes of adeno-associated viruses?
AAV2 is old. It's one of the first serotypes that was identified. However, we stuck with it because it's sticky. It likes to stay where it's put. And that is exactly what we want it to do and perform for us. We want it to stay in putamen or within the nigrostriatal system, as I've alluded to before. So that's a big benefit. AAV2 also is not as immunogenic as a lot of the other serotypes. It actually seems to put the immune system at bay. And again, I think the technology is advancing incredibly fast. We have way more capsids than just AAV2 and 9. There's a lot of iterations off of 9 because it's really good at spreading and can cross the blood-brain barrier. It still is not great at getting to the deep nuclei. So though it can spread, it can cross, it's not good at getting deep parts of the brain. And if that is still a desired target, direct delivery to the brain is still probably going to be the right place. And not for every gene therapy is going to be appropriate to be delivered across the entire CNS. You don't want that necessarily for every type of disease indication. And sometimes we need to be targeted and smarter about it. And this is part of why we stuck with the AAV2.
Well, that makes sense. So we're approaching the end of this interview. Let me wrap up with a couple of follow-up questions on the future of the field. So this phase 1b study achieved its main goal of safety, and the preliminary efficacy signals are definitely interesting, at least. Of course, it's still very early. Of course, there was no placebo arm. It was not a blinded study. Now, you are working on a new trial, which is already running, which is called the Regenerate PD trial. Can you tell us a little bit more about this?
Yeah, so it's very clear. We were excited by what we had seen in the phase 1Bs, as we just discussed. And again, looking at that moderate group and seeing, again, signal change was noticeable, and decided to then move that now into a bigger blinded randomized control study. So this is really first of its kind that's been able to do this. It's very challenging to do a blinded neurosurgical study. And then to do this for years on top of all of that. It's hard for us. It's hard for on the participants. This is a big challenge. And right now we are open in the US, and we have, I think, every country in the EU is open right now. So UK, Germany, Poland. So trying to get this study up and running, this is really our first chance to look and ask the questions in a blinded manner of AAV2 GDNF. So this is going to be really critical. Taking a lot of the elements from what we learned in the phase 1b, taking really that moderate group, and then just, again, asking what happens in compared to placebo. So this is going to be very interesting to see what these results look like in a few years.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to have you here with me, Amber. Thank you for joining me and for sharing all this very interesting results and insight on this fascinating world of gene therapy in Parkinson's disease.
Thank you so much. It was a real pleasure.
And thanks also to all our listeners for tuning in to the MDS podcast. If you'd like to read the full article, it's available now on the Movement Disorders Journal. And thank you all for listening.
If you enjoyed the conversation about this paper, you can further your experience with continuing medical credits, or CMEs. You can find the link to the journal CME course for this paper within the episode description on the MDS website. Journal CME is planned and implemented in accordance with the accreditation requirements of the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education, ACCME. The International Parkinson and Movement Disorder Society is accredited by the ACCME to provide a continuing medical education for physicians. The International Parkinson and Movement Disorder Society designates this education activity for a maximum of 1 AMA PRA Category 1 credits. The views and opinions expressed by the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the International Parkinson and Movement Disorder Society or their affiliated journals, Movement Disorders, and Movement Disorders Clinical Practice. Any disclosures of the participants can be found within the episode description located on the MDS website.